Welcome along to the Racing Riot podcast. I'm your host, Joshua Stacey, and I'm joined by my co-host, Charlie Post. Charlie, how have you been doing? It's been a busy, busy time for you.
Really busy time, Josh. You know, Doncaster sales sort of took up almost all of last week. Sold three, bought five, ended up with another seven or eight on top to break in. So probably 13 horses to get started over the last few days. So yeah, I've been pretty flat out.
I've been hearing you talk about the sales for a couple of years now, and I finally got involved. I went to the sales for the first time. It was a crazy experience. It's like a million miles an hour. I went away blown away. I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, it's for someone that's not been before, like you say, there's so much to take in. Never mind the fact that you have such a lot of young horses in a confined space, and so you need to be having eyes on the back of your head so you don't get bowled over. You also made the fatal mistake of turning up in a pair of very fetching, shiny black loafers. And as I said to you at the time, next time you come, you'll know it's comfort rather than style for these long days on your feet. And you want a pair of sort of walking shoes or trainers or something that's going to give a bit of comfort and support to your soles, especially when you're as tall as you, because after a few hours, I should imagine your feet were on fire.
Yeah, it was a rookie error. I thought first time, I'm not sure the dress sense. I'll go smart just in case. Better to be overdressed than underdressed. I was proven wrong and I looked a bit of a tit.
But you also got to see some very expensive stores go through the ring as well before you left.
Absolutely, yeah.
A couple of high, you know, £100,000 plus horses going to Paul Nichols, I think a Mount Nelson and a Cave Tara. So it was an exciting day, wasn't it? Yeah.
Definitely, and they all seem to go to Tom Malone. He is a serious powerhouse in the sales ring, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he seems to hoover up a lot of the talent.
He wants a horse, he gets it.
Yeah, I mean, I think especially when he's standing alongside Paul Nichols, you know, they're not often denied. And yeah, certainly when we watched the Cave Tara go through that made $155,000 or something, every time there was a response, I think from Kim Bailey stood down by the ringside that was mulling it over whether to go again. As soon as he did, it was like instantaneous bang, they went again, and they were going to have the horse, it seemed, at whatever the cost. And what also was, again, it just never ceases to amaze me is the resilience of the industry, as in trade was so strong. We went up there thinking that after everything that's gone on in the world, there might be some value as a buyer. There was no value, and you were paying premium prices for quality produce, and you had to work hard to find the ones that you liked, and then the ones that you liked and you could afford. It meant pretty hard work for the days.
Talking about Tom Malone's sales tactics, I have not spoken to you about this though, but when you were bidding for the horses that you wanted, you had a similar tactic as well. You'd sort of wait 45 seconds, look away, talk to other people. Is that intentional? It's almost like you were completely ignoring.
I think it's like anything, as in we don't have an unlimited budget. We tend to wait and see how it's going to unfold. We don't get stuck in bidding early. And then when we come in, you know, we're normally coming in when we feel that the bidding is starting to lull, and we're quite happy to fire back when it's within what we feel is the sort of value that we've put on the horse. But once it's nearing the maximum that we put on that individual, and it's not the same across the board, you know, depending on the quality of the individual, we will put a sort of what Francesca and I feel is a ceiling price. And yeah, when we get up to near that, we'll have a few chats and it's like, well, hang on a second, we came in here saying $25,000, $30,000, $35,000 was our maximum, but we like this horse. What are we going to do? Are we going to stretch the budget or not? And so a lot of the time you're weighing it up. You're also trying to feel, well, will one more bid get me this horse? Or do I feel that that's going to be worth it? If, say, I put $35,000 as a ceiling price on this horse, and if we have, is paying 40 going to really upset us? Or do we think 40 is worth risking? And yeah, do we feel if we did that, we're going to get the horse that we want? So it's a tricky one. I mean, certainly, I suppose if you're going in there and I don't know, and it's at $150,000, but you valued the horse to $180,000, well, it's easy to be aggressive with your bidding because in theory, you still feel you're getting value, don't you? So everyone plays it differently. It's a fascinating it's a fascinating spectacle just to go and watch, especially when those big money lots are going through and to see how it plays out. And I certainly remember being there, not that he's justified his price tag, but when Interconnected went through the ring and made 630 at the Horse in Train and Sale, and it was real sort of sporting theatre. And I remember that everyone sat in there sort of started applauding when the hammer came down, and the horse nearly went bananas. You could see the auctioneer panicking because he thought this is going to be a disaster. We've got all this money for this horse and now it's going to do itself an injury while everyone's clapping as it goes out. And so, yeah, it's certainly something that a race fan that hasn't seen it before, it's well worth going and experiencing.
If producing young race horses isn't for you, there is definitely a future in some sort of acting role. New York Gangster, it's right up your street. I was very impressed, I must say. But we've got plenty of good racing to get stuck into. We had two Irish classics at the weekend, the 2000 and the 1000 Guineas. Aidan O'Brien won the 1000 Guineas after winning the English 1000 Guineas with Mother Earth. He won that with Empress Josephine. Do you think the 1000 was particularly strong, both sides of the water?
Tough call, isn't it? I mean, certainly the vibe you get for me is over a mile that Aidan O'Brien doesn't have, like, standouts, you know, as in... Unfortunately for Ryan Moore, he's been on the wrong end of the decisions in almost all of them, you know, as in he wasn't on Mother Earth in the English 1000 Guineas, and he wasn't on Empress Josephine in the Irish 1000 Guineas. Now, one would presume that Aidan is trying to put Ryan on what he feels is the best chance in the race. I don't know if sometimes there's thinking with the future in mind, but certainly I would imagine from Ryan Moore's perspective, he would hope to be on Ballydoyle's best chance. And the fact that he's not been would suggest to me that much as there's quality there, because they're winning these classics, the fact that they're going in mob-handed suggests to me that they're lacking standouts in that division, for all that they're still winning them.
I do think that the fillies might struggle stepping up into open company later on in the season. I think the colts are a much stronger Max Sweeney and Poetic Flair. 1-2 in the 2000 Irish Guineas for Jim Bolger. He's just had a brilliant time, a brilliant month. Obviously winning the English 2000 Guineas as well. These two, I think they're quite smart.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to say that. I mean, first of all, I put a tweet up the other day. I mean, I just... And to give Ballydoyle their due, Aidan O'Brien, they also do it. But how refreshing is it the way that Poetic Flair's been trained? You know, no concerns about maintaining a perfect three-year-old season or anything like that. It's like, hey, you won the English 1000 Guineas, mate. Off you go on the boat to France and try and win over there. Didn't really get an awful lot of luck in running in the French 2000 Guineas, but ran creditably. And then... no chance of a break for you. You're out again to the Curragh and you're going to take in the Irish 2000 Guineas. And he was just denied, wasn't he? And I'm not saying you felt disappointed for him, but I said on the tweet, I feel like his reputation has been enhanced by being beat twice, because I love seeing top level performers in whatever sport they are, boxing especially, not trying to protect a perfect record or an unbeaten sequence, but going out there and taking on the best and accepting sometimes you're going to get beaten, sometimes you'll win. And Poetic Flair's got bundles of talent as an English Guineas winner, and he's also got toughness and durability to boot as well. And if they do decide to go to Royal Ascot in a couple of weeks' time, he's still going to be a major contender for the St. James Palace Stakes, because he's not going to have to take on Max Sweeney there, because he's going for the Derby, Josh.
Jim's got a special way of training and a real connection with his horses. What separates him to just a normal trainer?
Well, the fact that he breeds and owns most of his champions. I mean, Poetic Flair, for example, is by Dawn Approach, who Jim Bolger trained to win the 2000 Guineas and sold a significant stake into Godolphin, which I should imagine was pretty tidy business, one would think. And of course, the Guineas winner, Max Sweeney, the Irish Guineas winner, was out of New Approach, who Jim Bolger also trained to win the Derby. Again, owned by Sheikh Mohammed's wife, I think, the colours he ran in when he won the Derby. So what you're seeing here, and I think, again, they were bred on his own stud, they raced in his wife's colours, and what you're seeing is an incredibly intelligent man that sort of is doing it at all levels. Like I say, breeding, training, selling, champions, and I would imagine making significant sums of money from doing it, but I've got nothing but respect for him, because it's not easy. The breeding game is far from easy, and to be able to breed these sort of champions and then race them yourself, I'd have thought there's an awful lot of satisfaction there, Josh, as well.
Delighted to introduce to you our guest on this episode of the podcast. He enjoyed a massive win, one of the biggest of his career in the 2000 Irish Guineas at the Curragh. He's a big part of the Jim Bolger team, who saddled a 1-2 in the race. A pleasure to be joined by Rory Cleary. Rory, a weekend to remember.
Yeah, that's for sure. It was a weekend I'll never forget anyway.
Just tell me, when you crossed the line, winning the Irish 2000 Guineas, how did that feel?
It took a couple of strides after the line till I actually realised what I was after doing. Unbelievable. It's only starting to kind of sink in now, if you know what I mean. So it's fantastic.
Were there many celebrations that night, or was it back to work?
Oh no, it was back to work. Back to work, no celebrations yet. I'll be getting around to that sometime soon, hopefully. But just at the minute, we're still walking away hard.
I always get the impression from the stories of the fantastic riders that have and trainers and racing people that have come through the Jim Bolger Academy that I'd imagine he's fairly good at keeping your feet on the ground anyway.
Well, he keeps us busy, so it's easy to keep your feet on the ground when you're busy.
And I must admit, I went there a few years ago to the yard, and for the Robin Dickin that I was riding for at the time, we bought a horse off him called Vocalizer, and I got to ride out there with Tom Doyle, who was riding work there at the time, and it's a fantastic place, isn't it? I got very much the impression that nothing is left a chance in the Bolger yard.
Yeah, no, look at everything is it's such a fantastic facilities that's there, and you know, you couldn't but train horses there. It's you know, it's a great operation.
What makes him so special as a trainer?
I just think it makes him so special as a trainer. He breeds them. 90% of them are all his own homebred horses, and you know, he's very hands-on himself from day one with them, and you know, it's just brilliant the way he brings them on. He knows the pedigrees inside out, you know, from the dams and the sires. He knows the pedigrees inside out, and he knows how to train them, and I think that's what really makes him so special.
And this season's been fantastic. Poetic Flair, Max Sweeney. We need to talk about Max Sweeney. He obviously won the Virtus Futurity last year. That race is turning out to be, well, it always is been a good trial. But Cameco won it the year before, went on to win the Guineas. I wanted to ask you, actually, that the first time we saw Max Sweeney this year was over a mile and a quarter. Was the 2000 Irish Guineas always the plan, or was there something at the start of the season that you thought maybe stepping up in trip might work?
No, like, from his work and everything at home, I think, you know, the Derby trial was the race he always had planned for him. He ran a little bit disappointing, but he had his excuses after. He had a slight nasal discharge, and he just didn't want to go to the Epsom Derby on such a poor run. So he said he'd run the two of them in the 2000 Guineas, and just to make sure that he was back to himself, and definitely back to himself, if not better. You know, beating Poetic Flair, which we hold in high regards. Like, the two of them are very, very smart horses. So it's, for me, it was a great decision by him to run the two of them. So it's great.
How confident are you about Max Sweeney handling the step up to a mile and a half in the Derby?
Yeah, but like, sure, you've seen the way he raced on Saturday. He's just a very simple and easy to ride horse. He's, you know, covers the ground really well, and he settles really well, and the further he was going, the better he was going to the line. So, you know, I have no doubt he'll stay a bit further. So, you know, he's got the right attitude and the ability, so it's a big help.
And just talking about attitude, Poetic Flair, you know, three runs in different Guineas, three different countries within 3 weeks. I mean, how tough is he? I mean, what's he like at home?
Yeah, he's a very tough horse. Takes all his work really well, and he's very smart. Like, he's proven himself that he's right up there. You know, he's probably just a little bit unlucky that he didn't have the two Guineas, the Irish and the English. After winning the English, he's probably just unlucky he didn't have another Guineas under his belt. But you know, he's he's definitely a very good, solid horse.
And how's he come out of it? I mean, because Jim did mention, or Jim's daughter did mention, that the St James Palace could be a possibility. Has he been fine since the Curragh?
Yeah, no, the two of them came out of the race brilliant. Two of them rode out there on Monday, and the two of them looked brilliant and came out of the race really happy. So, I think the boss is very happy with the way they are at the minute anyway.
Going back to Guineas weekend, I mean, you've ridden a hell of a lot more winners than me, I mean, and been successful for an awfully long time, but big race chances don't come round time and again, and especially in a classic. And I just wondered, I mean, you talked at the time about the loyalty of Jim Bolger and everything, but I wonder from a mental approach point of view, how you approached the ride on Saturday.
I was quietly nervous about having to ride him because, you know, we hold him in high regard at home. Kevin rode him work earlier on in the week before the Guineas, and he worked really well. Even Kevin said it'd be hard to split the two of them, which he was proven right, like very hard to split the two of them. I won't lie, I was quietly nervous because I haven't had many rides in Group 1 races, never mind having a ride with it that actually has a chance, you know. To be fair, the boss, he never even thought about looking elsewhere. Like, he never second-guessed putting me on him, which is, you know, it's unbelievable. Like, there's not many trainers out there with his loyalty. And he's proven that over the years, that he doesn't use anybody else bar who's in the yard unless he really has to use somebody else.
Like I say, I think it's fantastic to see there's so many good riders out there that just need opportunity and getting a chance, and then it's about grasping it, which he did at the weekend. And what did he say to you afterwards, Jim?
He was delighted to have the 1-2 in the Guineas, and all I remember is when I rang him was just thanking him so much, and all he says was, "No, well done, you deserved that, you worked hard enough," and it's great that we got the result that we got, and that was it, you know, so it's fantastic.
Couldn't agree more, mate. Best of luck. Thank you very much. Really interesting that from Rory Cleary, Josh. I mean, like I say, I think the taking point from it was two of them. One, the gratitude that he felt of being part of the team. One of the lads, I think he almost referenced to himself and never imagined he would have a day like this. And then also, when I mentioned about the prize money factor for a rider that's doing perfectly well. You know, I mean, we're talking about someone that's having the guts of 400 rides a season, 20 winners. It's not a bad way to earn a living, not a bad career. But when he said that winning the Irish 2000 Guineas basically equated to what he would get to a whole season's worth of normal work, just shows you the importance of that.
I completely agree, Charlie. And it was an interesting point that you raised, and I want to explore that more with you. You had your fair share of winners each season, but those big rides in the big races, the likes of a Restless Harrier, Thomas Crapper, how did it feel? Was there an added pressure? Because I'd imagine you line up to the start in a race like that and go, "I'm not going to be able to do this that often. I really need to not only seize the opportunity, but like take it in as well."
Yeah, without doubt. I mean, people talk about pressure, and there's no doubt those big race riders on the flat, the Frankie Dettori's, the Ryan Moores, jumping in my lifetime, Tony McCoy, Ruby Walsh, have to deal with the untold pressure of delivering when you're expected to deliver. But as a journeyman rider, which is something that I hate the terminology of, but because I never viewed myself that way, but as someone that is just tipping away or doing averagely, there's an added pressure with trying to earn a living. And also the pressure of trying to stay loose, even though you know these big race rides aren't going to come around very often. So it's a different kind of pressure. And yeah, I feel like you did have to be careful not to let the situation get to you. And I mean, again, I'm not trying to equate riding in an Irish 2000 Guineas, but from an earning point of view as well, you knew these moments were important, because if you're Ruby Walsh or Tony McCoy or Frankie Dettori or Ryan Moore, you get beat because you get no luck in running an Irish 2000 Guineas. But you know the Derby, Royal Ascot, they're just round the corner, and redemption won't be far away. A chance to get more significant paychecks to keep the ball rolling. For a rider lower down the pecking order, you line up Rory Cleary in an Irish Guineas and you finish a short head behind, or you get no luck in running, and you know your chance is gone. One, of earning a lot of money, and two, of probably getting another chance at that level. And yeah, for certainly a jump jockey, I mean, even, I mean, like I say, the money is in nowhere near the same, but right, like riding a Welsh national winner, and I think I probably got, you know, $5,500 as my percentage out of it. Well, to me, that was like, it was the equivalent of at least probably 3 months riding wages, you know, as in, so they make a massive difference to your season, as in anyone that will tell you when they're tipping along in the middle somewhere as a riding career, what makes or breaks your season is a couple of those big debt paydays where you get a significant chunk of money for one ride and one afternoon's work. And it goes from being just another ordinary earning season relative to an ordinary wage in the working world to all of a sudden having a bit to put away and having you know, to look to the future with.
Rory said that after he crossed the line, it took him a couple of strides to really go, wow, I've just done that. Was there a ride in your career and a win that you went, that it took you longer than usual?
Yeah, I mean, the first big one that I won, the Welsh National, without doubt. I mean, again, it's boring to go over it because I've been, but there was a moment where, I mean, and it wasn't like it was a nip and tuck thing, you know, as in I won 7 or 8 lengths, but I crossed the line and I don't know, like there was a suddenly like 3 or 4 strides. You can see it because I don't really do anything when I go over the line, and then I get about 3 strides beyond the line, and all of a sudden they stand up and start giving it a big fist pump, because you suddenly have this realization.
Do you almost wish you did that crossing the line?
No, not really. As in, again,
for the moment,
it's never been my thing to be.
Oh,
like,
you're a showman.
No, I don't know if I am. No, I don't know if I'm an extrovert like that. So it's never been my thing to be sort of whooping and hollering and that, but. It just was, there was a huge feeling of self-satisfaction that, do you know what, whether my riding career is worth next to nothing or not, at least, yeah, when you click on the racing post or whatever else and you click on that big race wins column, there's actually going to be something there rather than what had been for the all of my career before that, no results found.
But your name was in history from that moment on.
Yeah, I mean, not. I don't think this is like the Battle of Hastings or something like that. But yes, I mean, I suppose
for
as long as the Welsh National's around, yeah, it would be nice to be on there on the Roll of Honour.
Absolutely. We talked about the sales at the start of the podcast. A horse that went for £570,000 last year. Classic Getaway made his debut for Willie Mullins in the middle of May or the end of May. What do you think of that?
Yeah, it's interesting. That's what I think about that, if I'm being completely honest, because it's not normally always Willie Mullins' style with these point-to-point recruits, so that you often don't see them for quite a long time. And so to be out 5 months later is sort of surprising.
Over 2.5 miles as well.
Yeah, in a May bumper. Yeah, as you say, quite rightly, over 2.5 miles. And he won by 15 lengths. I personally didn't think it was the most taking performance visually, if I'm being completely honest.
You're going to upset a few people here.
I can, yeah, and that's, but it's a game of opinions, isn't it? You know, as in,
what weren't you impressed with?
I don't know. There was something about the way that he went through the sort of last couple of furlongs that it just didn't. From a visual point of view, it didn't really resonate with me hugely. And that's not saying he's not going to go on and become a star. Or it just is a personal feeling that I had. You know, we also got in the aftermath, I think Patrick Mullins said that this lad was going to be more than likely embarking on a hurdling campaign come the autumn and not going to be kept to bumpers to go down the champion bumper route, Josh, which is, I don't know, do you read anything into that?
Not sure I read anything into it, into the horse's ability, but I quite like it. You know, you look at Akil Crew, who finished second in the bumper last year. Let's say he goes novice hurdling, runs in a supreme novice's hurdle next year, he will be 7. He'll then be 8 if he goes novice chasing. And by the time that we're seeing him in open company over fences, he's going to be 9. I thought he was impressive, and for a £570,000 purchase, you're going to want him to be impressive. Interesting that they start him off over this distance at this time of year, and he did look pretty green. I think we're going to have to wait and see with him. I think you could definitely see glimpses of a superstar. You just need him to now progress and show that.
Yeah, of course. And I agree with you. I think it is refreshing that they are going to go straight jumping with him rather than spending a season running in bumpers. As you say, they're coming from a point-to-point background. So in theory, it's not like they're completely unraced when they're racing, first of all, under rules. They've had a thorough grounding. And from these point-to-point trainers, they'll have done extensive galloping days away from home, a massive amount of schooling. So there's a real foundation there already. And so, yeah, I would completely echo your sentiment that it is nice to see him going straight away hurdling as a five-year-old rather than waiting another year. I suppose if I'm countering it, you can see from a trainer's point of view why they do it if they think they can. There's a lot of money in the bumpers. A lot of
prize money, yeah.
And so you're having a year, hopefully winning significant prize money in bumpers. You're then having another year as a novice hurdler where you're just racing against novices. Normally, if they're not going to become a champion hurdler, you then have another year as a novice chaser racing against fellow novices. And so you're able to possibly win a lot of races over a three-year period before you have to dip your toe in against experienced, older, graded campaigners and maybe find the ceiling of your ability, if that makes sense.
Completely agree. And I'm looking forward to seeing him next season. We had some very positive news today with regards to Royal Ascot and spectators at racecourses. Royal Ascot will welcome a crowd of 12,000 for each day of the prestigious five-day meeting. Next month, I want to be there. I will do anything to be there. It's one of those. 12,000 people, isn't that just brilliant?
That is fantastic news. I mean, again, when we heard about the 4,000 a day, I thought it personally, it was great on one hand that we're getting crowds back, but madness that in a venue as big as Ascot, especially, that we're only going to be allowed 4,000.
Completely agree, especially when you look at the likes of the football stadiums having 10,000, even some of the lower capacity football stadiums, they look quite full. And even Wembley, I think for the FA Cup final, they had 21,000. Mm. So if you're looking at Wembley, a stadium, when you've got Ascot, that's
outside.
Been
to Ascot?
Yeah.
I mean, how big is Ascot? I mean, 4,000 people in Ascot. You could go there and nearly not see someone for the day.
I know. It is 100% the perfect place to trial one of these trial events. And you know, even if you could fit 4,000 people just in the middle, like, and they'd have 10 metres each.
Completely agree. I mean, I'd say we're still going to struggle to get a ticket, though.
Before we head off, Charlie, I know you're doing a charity bike ride. Mm. Do you want to plug that?
I'd love to. Yeah. So Racing Welfare, which is an unbelievable charity. Please Google it and look up Racing Welfare. They do an incredible amount of work for anyone that's involved in the racing industry if they fall on hard times, and they've set up. Well, it's actually a good story. So Tom Messenger, Sam Davis Thomas, Connor Schumark, all ex-jockeys, and I, we were going to cycle from Perth Racecourse to Newton Abbott in the summer anyway, the four of us, to raise money for Racing Welfare. So I ring Racing Welfare up to say, can you be on board if we're going to do this and help us with some advertisement or publicity? And they went, you know what? We're actually already planning to do the same thing just from Carlisle to Newton Abbott. So they're sorting all the logistics.
What was the plan before?
Perth. So
you got away with that.
Yeah, we did. We've saved ourselves definitely a couple of hundred miles anyway. So yeah, we weren't complaining. You pay a fee to join in. I don't know if there's still spaces available, if there's any keen cyclists out there, and you have to raise a couple of grand.
My leg hurting already.
I can imagine.
Sorry, I can't make that.
You have to raise a couple of grand for charity. So begging bowl out, if anyone's listening and they would like to donate, if you go on my Twitter feed at Charlie Post, there is a tweet there that links you to my Just Giving page. And please, if you would and can, donate whatever you can, because it all goes to Racing Welfare. And as a charity, like I say, they do a massive amount for the racing industry as a whole. So it will be money well spent.
A very important cause. I've retweeted it and I will be donating, don't worry.